What to do, Shawty?
Murder stories lull the baby to sleep, okay?
We're a little weird at first, but you get used to us.
We're your favorite sisters.
Except for if you have your own sisters, probably.
No, but I'm gonna be, you know, your favorite.
We're gonna bump them bitches out of there.
Kick rocks, other sisters. No one likes you.
Kick rocks.
Wake the fuck up or shut the fuck up. No one wants to hear about that.
You just told them I like to poop. It'll be an adventure, and we hope that you come along for the ride. Please subscribe.
You'll make the baby cry if you don't.
Yeah, don't upset Ethan by not subscribing. That's just rude.
Welcome to Suspicious,
a podcast with two sisters
who are a bit obsessed with true crime,
unsolved mysteries,
extraterrestrials,
and all things strange.
Stay a while.
Let's get weird. Hey guys, welcome back to Suspicious.
Hey, hi, welcome. Hi there.
So, last week we talked about some crimes that happened in the open ocean. This week we're talking about how Angie's eating something right now, so she can't say anything. So this week we're talking about couples. Pairs.
Well, we kind of talked about couples last week too. Well,
we didn't.
Yeah, we did. It was at the very end of my story, and then your story was about a couple.
My story was about a murder of somebody who, people who happened to be married. I mean, it wasn't a couple story. This is like couples in crime. This is like Bonnie and Clyde.
Oh. Mine's not crime, though.
Well, maybe mine's not either. But maybe it is.
Liar. Liar.
Okay, well then what is your story about?
My story today is about the fabulous Tepperwins.
Tupperware?
Tepperwins. Tepperwines. Tepperwines. I don't know. Hang on. Let me see if I pronounce how to pronunciate it in here. Hang on. I might have. No. It's pronounced Tepperwine. Tepperwine. I do have it.
Tepperween?
Mm-hmm. Tepperwine.
Who are these people?
But it's spelled T-O-E-P-P-E-R-W-I-N. But it's pronounced Tepperwine.
Well, I spelt it very wrong in the title of this episode, and I'll need to correct that.
Yep, you do that. You fix that.
I will.
You didn't look it up first to see how it was spelled?
No, because I think I asked you when we were on the phone or tech, I don't know, whatever. I think we were on the phone, and so I just typed it in my notes as T-U-P-P-E-R-W-E-I-N.
Oh, you were off. You were wrong.
Phonetic.
Fail.
Anywho.
Anywho, let me take this gum out of my mouth. I needed a little fresh pick-me-up.
Your breath was killing yourself?
No, I don't know, it's flavored gum, so it tasted delicious.
It's magically delicious.
Does anyone else do that? Do you guys remember the Zebra Stripes gum, and it was super yummy, and then it would lose its flavor like 2 seconds in? And
you'd, I hate like, gum like that.
Constantly be like chewing it, spitting it out. I mean, they had a strategy.
So good when you first put it in. You're like, this is delicious.
That's what she said.
And then just straight anger a minute later.
That's also what she said. All right. Okay. So now, hi, guys. Hey. Hi. Hi there. Ho there. Okay. We're getting into my story. Let's go.
Boop.
Okay. So, the fabulous Tepperwins. Tepperwines. I don't know how to say it. I'm probably going to say it wrong because I wrote it through here like the whole time and I'm going to probably pronounce it wrong every time. So it's choose your own pronunciation. Sorry, not trying to be rude, but I try my best. Okay, so the son of a gunsmith, Adolf, also known as Ad Tepperwine, born 1869. He was born in, I think it's Borney? I believe, Arizona. It's B-O-E-R-N-E. Anyway, he was brought up in Leon Springs, and he learned to shoot with a crossbow and all kinds of guns before he turned 10. He also learned to shoot a 14-gauge shotgun around that age as well. And at 13 years old, His father died, and Ad was sent off to work. He worked for a pottery place in San Antonio. Sorry, Texas. Born Texas, not Arizona. Leon Springs, Texas.
Well, that changes things. And it makes more sense now that he was 10 years old and was shooting guns.
Sorry. I forgot to write down Texas above, and so then I just was like, I don't remember where this story is from. Sorry.
Default Arizona.
Arizona. No, this one's from Texas. Sorry. So he began working, making pottery in a San Antonio shop in Texas, and later that year, Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West show stopped here, and Ad got a chance to see the show, the show's fancy shooter, quote-unquote. Go ahead.
I just wanted to make one comment about the fact that his name is Adolf.
Yeah.
It's like,
he was born from German immigrants. So I think I mentioned that later, but his parents were German immigrants.
So, like, clearly they're on a certain side of...
No, it's 1869.
That was before Hitler?
Yeah. Yes. Like 100 years.
Okay.
Well, less than 100 years, but like 80 years before.
But what is time?
It's relative. It's linear. It's up and down.
That makes me feel better, because at first I was like, okay, his parents are racist. Okay, continue.
Okay, so Ad got a chance to see the fancy shooter, W.F. Doc Carver. Doc was tall, with his hair worn shoulder length and ringlets. Carver was an impressive figure as he stood and shot coins and feathers from glasses. He shot balls on both feet and horseback. He was apparently a dentist who turned marksman. Carver worked hard to become the forefront of the shooting sports, and he wasn't just a shooting act, but Cody's partner. After this, Ad taught himself to do everything that he had seen Carver do. At 20 years old, Ad worked as a cartoonist and used his connections with the San Antonio Express to speak with George H. Walker, the manager of an opera house. He was able to get his own trick shooting act set up, and Walker invited reporters and vaudeville bookers to watch Ad, as he was called the quote-unquote tall Texan.
Vaudeville?
It was like vaudeville is what they like their performance and stuff, like their acts and things were back in the day. That's what they called them. Like, it was like their show.
Like theater?
No, it was like live acts. So like if you
That's
went to
I mean
showgirls and things
yeah.
like that, yeah. Oh, okay. at a theater, yes.
Yeah.
So he was known as a tall Texan, and they came to watch him. He hit every target in Coney Island and the shooting gallery, and the prize for doing this was cigars. But since Ad didn't smoke, he gave them all to the reporters. So the following day, the New York World said that the other shooting galleries closed to prevent a repeat of, you know, Ad winning all the prizes. And this then launched Ad's career, and he got an offer from B.F. Keith's vaudeville circuit and spent the next 2 years in the variety stage, followed by several more years with a Mexican circus. In 1901, Ad joined the Winchester Repeating Arms Company, the manufacturer of firearms and ammunition.
I've heard of them.
Yes. Winchester Mystery House. Been there. So fun.
And also the Winchester firearms.
Well, yeah. Okay. So, but this is in San Antonio. This is in Texas, remember. Not Arizona. And not San Jose, California.
Yeah.
So he started at first as a supervisor of its trade fair exhibits, but he was disappointed regulated to only talking about guns rather than shooting them. But he was still determined to learn everything he could about the company. And while on one of the factory tours in 1902, they were in New Haven, Connecticut, he had asked to be introduced to the operator of a cartridge making machine. So it's the machine that you kind of like pull down and it like makes the cartridges for the gun. The
bullet. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So this operator was 18-year-old Elizabeth Servetti. I'm probably pronouncing her last name wrong. He was struck by her beauty and remained in contact with her even when he went away after his trip. So they were in constant contact. Elizabeth, she was born January 23rd, 1882. She was the daughter of German immigrants, which was something her and Ad had in common. When Ad returned to New Haven in 1903, him and Elizabeth were wed, and she moved to San Antonio to live with Ad's mother and sister, Clara. And by the accounts that I saw, Ad's family took immediate liking to Elizabeth. And this time, by this time, Ad had his dream job. He was an exhibition shooter. Touring for the Winchester Company, he promoted their products by conducting fantastic feats that drew crowds and press from all over. Quote, in these days, hunting and recreational shooting were everyday activities, unquote, says the curator of the Buckhorn Museum, John Stein. Meanwhile, Elizabeth was alone a lot with not a lot to do, so because Ad was on the road for months at a time. And during one of Ad's return trips home, Elizabeth told him she wanted to learn to shoot, and that if she learned to shoot, she might be able to find a role with him on the road. Ad agreed and started to teach Elizabeth to shoot. And while she worked for Winchester for many years, she never actually fired a gun. So this actually was not uncommon for the time, and it was actually very rare for women to use firearms during the like 1800s and early 1900s. Ad decided to start Elizabeth out with the first gun that actually inspired him, which was a .22. Elizabeth took to the new skill very fast, and after a month, she was shooting chalk and crayons from Ad's lips and out of his outstretched fingers.
Damn, that's trust right there.
Mm-hmm. She could even group together her shots so close on like a bullseye that it would create a hole that you could cover with a nickel. So she was able to group her shots really tight, yeah. She was such a fast learner that Ad quickly moved her from stationary objects to aerial targets. Again, Elizabeth was a natural and could knock over any size tin can out of the sky. Ad gave her the nickname Plinky, as she would exclaim, "I plinked it." And it was also the sound that kind of the cans made when you shot them.
Yeah. Make the sound.
Plink. Plink, plink, plink. Plink, 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 plink,
plink, pew, plink, pew, plink, plink.
Pretty much. Pew, pews, plink, plinks. In 1904, the duo would begin to perform together. But at first, Plinky's expenses were not paid. So the young couple barely broke even, having to pay her way with Ad's wages. Their first and only child, Lawrence Clark, was born February 12th, 1904. And after a few months after he was born, Ad and Plinky were off again, this time to St. Louis for a six-month engagement at the World's Fair.
Do you know if they took their kid with them, or did he stay with the family?
No, I believe he stayed with the family. He stayed with the grandmother,
yeah.
Ad's mom. So at the World's Fair, they made their debut as a performing couple. And from then on, they would travel together, both as Winchester employees. So both being paid, being billed as the famous Tepperwines. But they were often known as the Tops.
Which is easier to pronounce for sure.
Yeah. So they were set now to earn a living, and they also began to draw bigger crowds. And when Ad and Plinky would come to town, everything would shut down. In one case, the duo put on a show in East Texas town, the same weekend that a prolific murder trial was being conducted, and when it was announced that the Tepperwines could not delay the show, the judge quickly announced that he was adjourning the jury until 10 o'clock the next morning, And as Plinky and Ad lined up in the center of town to start to perform, the judge, the jury, and every spectator from the court were in attendance to watch.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, right?
Let's push back this murder trial a day.
These guys shoot things, so we're going to just put a pin in this until tomorrow morning and come back to it.
We know he did it. What's a day going to do?
What's a day going to do? These are the Tepper wines.
That's so stupid.
So during his parents' trips, just stated, Lawrence would usually stay behind with his grandmother and his aunt, so they would watch him. The Tepper Wines tour was very grueling, and every other day they were on a train to the next city, sometimes even in the same day. This is according to Stein, and they worked outside in the rain, the cold, the extreme heat, and not content to perform the same act over and over, the Tops sought out new challenges all the time. Back in 1904, at the World's Fair, over a three-day exhibition, Ad would score 19,999 hits out of a possible 20,000. This was his first official record that he broke and held. But also, not to be outdone, Plinky established her first world record when she hit 967 out of 1,000 thrown clay discs. The best mark ever for a female shooter.
Nice.
So, you know, she wasn't too shabby herself. She was very good. Also, perhaps Ad's most impressive well-known record occurred between December 13th and December 22nd, 1907. He devised an endurance feat where he purchased all of the ammo he could in town and set out to shoot straight for 10 days. He shot 72,500 targets, missing 9. Twice on the 17th and twice on the 21st target. Ad hit then 8,000 in a row without missing, and on the 20th of December, which was his worst day due to poor weather, he missed a total of 4 shots out of 7,000.
Jesus.
He rotated his guns every 500 shots because the barrel would overheat, and by the time he was done, every ammo in San Antonio was gone.
That's crazy.
On the 10th and final day, he began to black out because he was just so fatigued and overwhelmed, just exhausted.
Delirious. Yeah.
He was saved when the boy throwing the targets kept him from falling down. He shot at hand-thrown wood blocks, those were his targets, for 7.5 hours each day. He wanted to shoot an even 75,000, but again, they ran out of ammo, so that's why he stopped. Plinky would also subject herself to grueling feats of stamina as well. So in 1916, Plinky made a run at 2,000 straight targets while in Montgomery, Alabama. She was forced to stop for a moment when a blister broke open on her hand, and after a doctor treated it, she went right back to shooting. After about 12 more shots, she ripped off the bandage as it interfered with her shooting. When she was finished, she hit 1,952 shots out of 2,000 with a bloody hand. And actually, she shot better with the injury during the second half of the 1,000 rounds than she did with the first half of the 1,000 rounds.
That's funny.
So Plinky was the first woman in the country to qualify as a national marksman using a military rifle, says the Handbook of Texas. She was the first woman to break 100 targets trap shooting, a feat that she had often repeated more than 200 times. She won the women's world championship. She set individual records both for men's and women's, some which still stand today. Ad could also hit targets while laying on his back or standing on his head. Plinky could put 500 bullets into a bullseye 5 inches in diameter. She could hit anything an assistant tossed in the air, including tomato cans, playing cards, potatoes, eggs, marbles, washers with tissue paper in the center, 2-inch blocks, pennies, and pesos.
Wow.
One of Ad's favorite tricks to do was to ask the biggest man in the crowd to toss an object for him. Sometimes The items would be flung so hard and so high in the air, the audience would lose track of them. But Ad never did, and he would bring them down with a shot. The couple also won local shooting contests. They also used their precision sports trainings to become good bowlers as well. It was said that the couple occasionally missed on purpose to heighten the suspense. Ad would stop and kiss Plinky every time he missed, says Marty Forbell, who saw the couple at a Boy Scout camp demonstration. And even the famous Annie Oakley said, "Mrs. Topps, you're the greatest shot I've ever seen," quote unquote. The couple made Ripley's Believe It or Not several times, but never made much money. And they were very humble from beginning to end. So, meanwhile, while the Topps were out performing, their son grew up attending the ancestor schools of Central Catholic High School and St. Mary's University. Lawrence also went to work at the Express, where he drew cartoons and did police reporting, wrote magazine features. He also published detective stories in pulp magazines. He worked at the paper for 17 years until a year before he died in October 20th, 1940, and he died in his parents' home where he and his wife were living. According to his death certificate, Lawrence, a court reporter at the time, succumbed at the age of 36 to cirrhosis of the liver, meaning he's an alcoholic, yeah. Edema of the brain, and Bright's disease, which means kidney failure. His parents were in St. Louis performing at the time, and per Clara, Ad's sister, she informed them of his death, and the death certificate and funeral postponed so that Plinky and Ad could attend.
Part of me thinks, like, I wonder if he became an alcoholic because his parents were never around when he was a kid.
Maybe, but his grandma and his aunt were.
Yeah, but that's not his parents, you know?
Yeah. Some people don't have moms and dads that are raised by their grandparents and they're not alcoholics.
No, I know. I'm just saying, like, because if you have parents who basically, like,
are in and out
because of their career or for whatever, like, I'm sure it has an impact on the kid of, like, why aren't my parents around? Like,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Anyways, that's just my thought.
Thanks for bringing this down. I'm just kidding.
We talk about murder. Like,
that
brings us down.
With the start of World War II. Oh, another World War II! The Tepperwines embarked on a tour of military installations. excuse me. Their last tour was in 1943. And as Plinky told the Light, that tour was exhausting but pleasurable. Plinky died at home on January 27th, 1945, 3 months after suffering a heart attack. During her lifetime, Ad joked with her that she was his, quote, current wife, unquote, but he never remarried. Ad kept touring for Winchester until 1951, when he stepped back to be an advisor for the company. He gave free lessons at Leon Springs Lodge, appeared at shooting contests, and helped train a new pair of married marksmen, Dot and Ernie Lind. After a lifetime of shooting without any protective equipment, Ad gradually lost most of his hearing. Then he got glaucoma and cataracts, which took his eyesight, but he still walked 3 miles a day to keep fit, until shortly before he died on March 4th, 1962, from heart disease. He was 92.
Dang.
Ad and Plinky's career spanned more than 40 years. I think it was like 42 exactly, but so it spanned over 40 years. They were buried at Mission Burial Park in San Antonio. There is memorabilia of the Tepperwins' career and life on display at the Buckhorn Saloon in San Antonio. Since 1963, there's been an annual Tepperwin Memorial Skeet Shoot that has been held in San Antonio's Gun Club for couples in their honor. I'm sorry, in the couple's honor, not for couples. In 1969, they were inducted into the Trap Shooting Hall of Fame in Vandalia, Ohio. Vandalia. I don't know how to say it. It's V-A-N-D-A-L-I-A, Ohio. So they were inducted into that Hall of Fame. And that is the story of the fantastic, amazing, fabulous Tepperwines.
Fetch. Fantastic, amazing, fabulous, and fetch.
Oh.
Stop trying to make fetch happen.
Yeah. Stop trying to make fetch happen. It's not going to happen.
When you told me about the story originally and you're like, oh, they're a shooting couple, they're a shooter. Like, I thought you meant crime.
Oh. I thought I told you they were like performers.
No, you just told me, like, the blurb you told me, I think that I wrote down was just, let me see. That's not it.
Well.
Tepperwine, husband and wife shooting team. So because we're true crime, I just assumed they were like murderers. And so I didn't realize it until like a third of the way through the story. And when you were talking about like the Winchester, and then he worked for Winchester, and I was like, oh, that kind of a shooting team.
So, I mean, still, if your couple shoots, or it's a couple, it'll still tie in.
No, totally.
Sorry, I'm not always going to talk about murders and true crimes and things. I like to talk about old-timey interesting things. This is another, again, old-timey interesting thing.
That's fine.
I need to be more clear apparently with you.
No, okay. It's fine. You don't have to. I just thought it was funny that, like, partway through the story, I was like, oh, I get it. They're a shooting team. I get it.
Exhibition shooters. Sorry.
Yeah. Very interesting and super, like, impressive, her shooting, her shooting skills. Yeah. Good story.
Thanks. I thought it was really interesting because originally, I think I found it on Facebook. Someone posted about Plinky, and I was just going to do it on her, but then I realized that, she would shoot with her husband, and a lot of the stories were either just about her, which is fine, or just about him, and so I thought I would tell their story together.
Yeah, might as well combine it.
Yeah, because they were both a part of each other's lives, and he taught her how to shoot. I mean, granted, she picked up shooting super fast, and she was, like, they were legit amazing shooters. And,
yeah.
Yeah. So I just thought it was interesting. Interesting, fun story.
Yeah.
But you're...
It makes me want to go to a shooting range.
Right? Well, it makes me want to go see one of those shooting exhibitions where they shoot, like, crazy things from the air or whatever.
Yeah, that'd be fun. Have you ever been to a shooting range? I've never been.
Yeah, I've shot guns before.
I've shot, like, Nate's guns.
Oh, no. I've shot...
like, airsoft rifle and stuff.
Oh. Yeah, no, I've shot actual guns. Like, I shot 22s, I shot 45s, I've shot AR-15s. So, I do like shooting...
saying, don't get on your bed, sir.
Don't get on my bed, sir. No, I do like shooting the assault rifles, though, because they are, like, there's no kick on them, and it just is so nice. They just shoot so smooth when you're, like, shooting targets downrange. So fun.
Okay, so, because I probably will always tell a true crime story.
Yeah, do it.
I decided to...
I mean, don't get me wrong. I love true crime too, but sometimes I gotta just change it up, at least for myself in research.
No worries. I'm just saying, more than likely, if you change it up, don't worry, because I'm gonna bring in the crime. So, I'm gonna talk to you about a story of Benjamin and Erica Seifert. Okay, so I'm gonna give a little bit of background about each of them before I tell you their story together. So I'm going to ignore the faces that you're making and say that Erica Elaine Grace was born February 3rd, 1978 in Roaring Spring, Pennsylvania, to parents Charlotte and Gerald Grace. She was a basketball star in her high school days, and it was said that her parents built her an indoor basketball court so that she could practice any time of day, regardless of weather conditions. which obviously goes to the fact that they had money if they can build an indoor basketball court for their daughter.
Oh, you mean you don't just get that all day, every day?
I don't think it's some standard with most houses.
Are you sure?
I don't think so. We should look into that.
Yeah, we need to look into that.
So it was said that she pushed herself to be really great, but her father pushed her even harder. So she wouldn't be able to come in for dinner until she hit 10 free throws in a row without missing, which is, like, I guess a good way to push her, but seems a little extreme in my opinion.
Yeah.
So she graduated high school in 1995 with a partial athletic scholarship from Mary Washington College in Fredericksburg, Virginia, where she continued to play basketball and was an honor student. She would unfortunately not be able to go pro with a basketball career because of her size. So she was really petite and short. So pro really wasn't an option for her. So Benjamin Adam Seifert, a.k.a. BJ, was born October 21st, 1977.
Can I just say something?
Iowa, of course.
Please, please don't name your kids where their nicknames or their
initials.
Acronym names are
BJ.
Sexual things, BJs. Don't name your kid BJ.
I mean, but he could have went by Ben. So his name is Benjamin Adam. It's not like his initials were BJ. He, I'm assuming, chose BJ or something.
Okay, be wary of anyone with nicknames like BJ. BJ, HJ, ZJ.
I was like, HJ, got it.
What's a ZJ? If you have to ask.
Hold on, let me think. Take my brain a second. What's a ZJ?
it's from Beer Fest.
I haven't seen that.
If you have to ask, you can't afford it.
Do they say what it is, or is it?
No, they just say that. Because he's like, what's a ZJ? Because I was waiting for you to say, what's a ZJ? And he goes, if you have to ask, you can't afford it. And he's like, Mantonio, get out of here. Okay, sorry.
So I played into the joke perfectly.
Yes. Like, mom tried to do with me the other day. Have you heard the word?
What's the word?
Bird, bird, bird. Bird is the word. She tried to get me with that. And I was like, she goes, have you heard the word? She goes, have you heard the word? And I was like,
I've played,
you mean the bird?
Every year of your life. You can't play it back on
me. Right? She tried to get me, and she didn't.
That's funny.
Yeah, she totally tried to get me. Okay, sorry. That was way off track.
That's fine. Yeah. So he was born 10/21/1977 in Estherville, Iowa, to Elizabeth and Craig Seifert. He grew up in the Midwest, and mostly in Houston, Texas. Another Texas story. So he was really a go-getter and worked hard for whatever he needed and would usually obtain it. And in high school, he won many awards for his accomplishments on the swim team and was also a lifeguard during that time as well. So he graduated high school in 1996 and promptly enlisted in the Navy and began his SEAL training. In 1997, he completed his basic underwater demolition SEAL training and was number one in his Navy class. He then began the rest of his training to become a full-fledged SEAL. So now comes when they meet. So Erica and Ben meet in 1998 when they were both 20 years old, and they married 3 weeks later by eloping in Vegas.
I think I might know this story. Now that you're talking about it more, I think I might know it, but continue.
Maybe. So clearly, like, I don't remember what my commentary was going to be, but it had to do with the fact that they got married after 3 weeks. Like,
hi, I barely know your name. Let's get married.
I think we're perfect. So Erica was an avid scrapbooker and commemorated the event in her book by writing, "Best decision I have ever made."
So apparently that is not the best decision that she's ever made, because no one ever says that
in scrapbooking. So they were described as an all-American couple, and her, their friends, you know, seemed to be very happy together and, like, really clicked. They were both kind of adrenaline seekers as well, and so they kind of fed off of each other in that way. Erica was a bit jealous and possessive of Ben and would show up on his Navy base and accuse him of cheating and generally cause a bit of
best decision ever.
Best decision ever, hashtag. So she ended up convincing Ben that he didn't need the Navy and that he should leave and follow her. And so he went AWOL and received a bad conduct discharge from the Navy for going AWOL, as well as for insubordination, poor performance, and wearing unauthorized insignia, which is a far fall from him being number one in his Navy class.
Yeah.
So clearly their relationship is benefiting him. And during the time that he was being discharged from the Navy and was kind of spiraling, Erica ended up graduating cum laude from Mary Washington College with her BA in History and Political Science. Shortly after marrying, they moved to Altoona, Pennsylvania, which was nearby her hometown, and the couple opened up a scrapbooking store together called Memory Lane.
Altoona. All the tunas.
Every single tuna.
So, tuna on your scrapbook, tuna on your handle, tuna on your toaster, yeah. Tuna on your shelf. I don't know.
Ben, who was previously like a man's man, very tough guy, would go out drinking and like drink everyone under the table, used to doing basically whatever he wanted, and was able to fill his like adrenaline needs with his Navy SEAL training and activities, began to kind of downward spiral because all of that was out of his life at this point. It was said that when they first were together, like they had like crazy sex all the time. It was on and popping. But after he left the Navy life, his testosterone levels kind of plummeted and he was almost like asexual. And so that took a toll on their relationship.
Was he like doing like steroids in the Navy?
No, I think it was just that
he lost his purpose.
Yeah, and like again, he was like an adrenaline seeker, and so he had none of that going on. And I don't know, it was tied in some way, right? So, in an effort to kind of like raise the stakes in their lives to see if they could spice things back up, the couple began breaking into stores in the nearby shopping area that they worked at. And it worked. So Ben, you know, was getting excited from the adrenaline and they were then able to have a normal sex life. So during this time, which was around 99 and 2000, Erica became obsessed with Hooters memorabilia. And so the couple ended up breaking into several local Hooters and stole merchandise. And they were never caught or charged for these crimes. Okay, so over time, they ended up needing to kind of like keep upping the ante and keep raising the stakes so that it was like more and more exciting because eventually it got boring if they kept doing the same thing. They then began dabbling in prescription drugs and other street drugs, mostly cocaine, and were avid partiers just to kind of keep that lifestyle up. So now we're going to jump to Memorial Weekend in 2002. The couple, now 23, decide to take a vacation to Oceanside, Maryland, which is a little beach town that attracts a lot of tourists, and they were going to stay there for a week. So they rented a condo. Where's the name of it? It's further down somewhere.
I think I have heard about this one. I think I heard about it on one of my murder shows.
Maybe. So they stayed for a week at the Rainbow Condo Complex. The condo that they rented was on the top floor of a 20-story building right in the downtown area of Ocean City. So there was tons of eateries and bars and all of that happening right around them. So the couple decided to go to a local bar and tourist hotspot called Secrets. On the shuttle bus to Secrets, they met Joshua Ford and Martha Crutchley, who went by the name of Jeannie. Joshua was a mortgage broker from Boston. He was 32 and recently divorced. And Jeannie was older, at 51, an insurance executive, and they had been dating for some time, lived together, and it was said that they were super in love. So they also basically went for the weekend to Ocean City for a vacation, for Memorial Weekend. So when getting on the bus, Erica and Ben didn't have the right change amount for the fee, and so Josh offered to pay for them. And then in return, Ben said that when they got to Secrets, they would buy them some drinks. So they get to Secrets, and the couple begin drinking together, telling stories, laughing. And then at some point, the conversation turns to Erica and Ben offering them, when the club closes down, to come back to their condo. and they could basically continue the party. It's believed that drugs and sex were involved. And so the couple obliged. They all ended up going back to the Rambo condo complex. And they continued drinking. They smoked some weed. They were playing really loud music, generally just continuing the party from the bar. And then they all ended up in the hot tub together. So randomly, Erica decides to get out of the hot tub and go upstairs to her room, where she immediately begins yelling, "Where's my pocketbook? Someone stole my pocketbook." So Ben jumps out of the hot tub, goes to get his .357 Magnum, and then starts pointing it and waving it at the couple and asking, like, "Where's the pocketbook? Who took it?" and causing a scene. So while he's doing that, Erica's upstairs and decides to call 911. And the dispatcher answers and asks her if the call's an emergency. And I'm not sure if I can play the audio clip. I don't know if that's, I think it's public information, but so I got quotes from it. But so she says, and in a super like calm monotone voice, "Yes, I have an emergency at my apartment. There are people in my house who I don't know, and my purse is suddenly missing, and I'm afraid I'm going to have a robbery up here." And then she says, "I'm upstairs in the bedroom where they don't know where I am." And the dispatcher says, "Okay, I'll connect you to the police department," because it ended up, the original call went to somewhere that was further away. So the call gets transferred, and then the police station nearby answers, and she says, "Hello, there are people in," and then the line's dead. She hangs up. So conveniently, before the cops can get any information from her, like a name or an address, the call is dead, so no cops ever respond. And then detectives believe after the fact that she was either just toying with them or potentially thinking ahead, like, this would be a good alibi, right, in case
something happens, in case, yeah.
So, meanwhile, downstairs, Ben is still pointing the gun at the couple. And so Joshua grabs Ginny and they run into the bathroom and lock the door and kind of barricade it with their bodies. So Erica, now that this adrenaline is pumping in her body, goes onto the balcony and leans over to a window that she can see through to the bathroom to see where the couple is. So at that point, she basically gives that information to Ben, tells him where to point the gun, and tells him to fire on her command, basically. So she's looking through the window into the bathroom and signals to Ben to pull the trigger. So the bullet goes through the bathroom door and hits Joshua in the head. He instantly falls to the ground. And at that point, Ben kicks in the bathroom door and Joshua's body is just laying there, blood pouring from his head. And then Jeannie, who's cowering under the vanity, is begging for her life, pleading for mercy, like, "Don't kill me." So Ben walks over Joshua's body and shoots her as well. So now that both Joshua and Jeannie were dead, the couple was now tasked with getting rid of the bodies. And if you remember, the condo that they're in is top of a 20-story building in a very populated area on a holiday weekend, tons of people around, so it's not like they can just carry a body downstairs. So the couple decide that they need to dismember the bodies and carry them down piece by piece. So the body parts were put into trash bags and were taken down to their Jeep Cherokee. And once all the body parts were removed from the condo, the couple drove from Maryland into Delaware and began disposing of the trash bags in multiple dumpsters along the way. And eventually all of them actually ended up in a massive landfill in Delaware.
Also, if you're going to transport your dead body parts, don't cross state lines, because that's how the feds get involved.
Tips. Tips and tricks.
Join us for our tips and tricks section next time on Suspicious. So, do you need help getting rid of a dead body? Have you watched any murder shows? Sorry.
Come join us for the 10 best tips.
No, don't.
Just kidding.
We're kidding. Do not sue us. We have no money.
So after dumping the body parts, the couple head back to Ocean City and end up stopping and playing mini golf. And so
no,
literally just...
That's... Oh, yeah, let's go play mini golf. We just butchered and murdered these two people. Let's play mini golf. I'm going to get a hole in one.
So they're like stopping, having fun, like taking selfies, generally just going on like nothing had happened. So super heartless and showing obviously no signs of remorse. And in one of the pictures that they took, you can see that Erica is wearing a chain with a ring on it. It's actually Joshua's ring, and there was still blood on it, which is super gross. Also, she, on her hip, was wearing a knife, and that was the knife that was used to help dismember the bodies, and it still had blood and pieces of flesh on it.
Oh, yeah, because, you know, heaven forbid you wash your shit after you're done.
Right. Okay, so then...
They're going back to the bloody condo?
Well, not quite. They have a couple stops to make. So after mini golf, they decide that they need to go to Home Depot to buy a new door for the bathroom because the current one has a bullet hole in it.
Oh, oops.
And Erica, being the scrapbook queen that she is like, hey, let's like stop in the parking lot. Let me take a picture of you in front of Home Depot for our scrapbook.
Oh, God.
To commemorate this event.
Let me scrapbook our first murder. Our first murder.
So
here we are at Home Depot getting supplies.
Jeez. So they get the door, and then they also stop and get cleaning supplies. So like bleach, tile cleaner, stuff like that. They go back to the condo and begin cleaning up all the evidence of the crimes that they had committed. And it's also worth mentioning that at some point, she also finds the time to update a page, and she calls them basically the modern day Bonnie and Clyde. And there's also a picture of the souvenirs that she kept from the victims.
Idiot.
It's like stupid.
100% idiot. She deserves to be caught and slammed in jail forever. 100%, 100% idiot. You're a dumbass.
100%, yeah. So, okay, now once the condo was cleaned completely, they have the bright idea to go back out on the town, and I'm assuming, see if anyone else dropped their
Let's do it again!
Exactly. Because later that evening, they go back out, I think to the same bar, but I'm not 100% sure on that, and they meet a couple, Melissa Sealing and Justin Todbright. And the scenario plays out very similarly, where the couple is lured up to the condo, promises of a good time. Luckily, Melissa and Justin escape with their life. Now, it's not clear as to how they were able to escape. There's
I was going
to
ask,
theories.
Do you know? Yes.
There's a couple theories. So one of them is that...
They got weirded out by these freako couples.
Maybe.
She was like, do you want to look at my scrapbook of murder?
I think we should go.
Can I show you my scrapbook? Can I have your ring for my scrapbook? My precious scrapbook.
So one of the theories is that the couple either had to leave early, maybe got spooked, whatever, and left before any of the craziness began. But another theory is that Ben and Erica realized that they had to leave town the next morning anyways, and that they were going to be running out of time to murder them, butcher them, take them somewhere, clean it up. So, meanwhile, the friends and family of Joshua and Jeannie reported them missing because they didn't show up for work. And it was super out of character for them, especially Jeannie, because she hadn't missed a day in over 20 years. So, Oceanside Police took it very seriously, ended up putting up missing person flyers all over town. They sent out a police alert to make sure all the personnel were aware. They talked with witnesses who identified that they remember seeing the couple on the shuttle to the bar with another couple, which were the unidentified cyphers at the time. So Erica and Ben pack up all their belongings. They decide to head out of town back home. But before they completely leave, one last hurrah, they decide to hit up a local Hooters for some more memorabilia because you can't have enough.
Hootie Hoots!
Give
luckily, me those
a silent alarm was triggered when they entered the establishment, and the cops arrived with Erica and Ben still in the store. So
Thank
they were
God.
Handcuffed. I know, right? They were handcuffed and made to sit on the curb.
Also, freaking idiots! I'm gonna go run with Hooters after I just dismembered somebody.
Right? Because
that makes sense.
It wasn't.
You really got to get your chicken wings and your Hooter shorts.
I need my fried pickles and my tube top.
Idiot.
So the cops at this time, again, were just thinking they caught some burglars. And so, again, Erica being the dumbass that she is, she starts having a panic attack and asks one of the arresting officers if they can grab a Xanax from her purse so that she can calm down. And surprisingly, the officer was going to oblige, but told her, like, I'm going to need to check your purse first. So while he's searching the bag, he sees 5 spent 38 shell casings, along with the 2 IDs of the missing people from Virginia that the police department had just been made aware of hours earlier.
So she kept the shell casings too?
Shell casings and their IDs.
She's an idiot. Also,
in the purse
they were going to find
that the cop to go into.
Well, they were going to search the purse anyway when they take her into custody at the jail. So they would have found it literally like 20 minutes later anyway.
If they would have searched the purse, but it would have went into like it would have been confiscated. Thank you.
Idiot.
But still, she literally asked them to go in the purse with the IDs.
Can you guys go in? I need a Xanax. I'm having a panic attack. Can you go in my purse? It's right in the pouch past the bullet casings next to the 2 IDs. Can you go in there and grab that Xanax for me? Again, it's past those 5 bullet casings and next to the 2 IDs. There's my Xanax. Can you get me one? I'm having a panic attack.
Just don't think about anything else you're seeing, though. So after being taken into custody, and once they were questioned separately, the couple decide to turn on each other. So Ben indicated...
Son of a bitch.
Ben indicated that he was asleep in the Jeep while all the mayhem occurred.
Oh, okay. I sleep in the Jeep. We have a condo, but... And then we were up partying, but I'm just going to go sleep in this Jeep.
Yeah, makes no sense. Like,
no, idiot.
At least try to make it realistic. So Erica's story was that it was completely Ben's doing. She was merely a victim herself and was petrified of what was going on. And, basically she was afraid for her safety if Ben even found out that she was talking to the police about this.
It was totally Ben. I'm so scared that I dangled off of my roof to look into the bathroom to tell him where to shoot that guy because I was scared.
I will say that you are way more animated than Erica because legitimately, so there's a recording of her confession and I have some quotes from it, but like literally she's the most like monotone. Like, so during her tape confession, she said he has SEAL friends. I definitely would not want him to know that I was here talking to you. And if I go up and testify for some reason, you guys don't get him, my family will end up like Joshua and Jeannie. To which the detective asked, dead? And she agreed.
Yes, dead. If you don't do something, he's going to murder me.
No, you're still even putting like some kind of like emotion.
Oh, so she was more robot? Like, yes. If you don't do something, he will murder me.
Point on point.
It was not me. It was him. He murdered the people. I just sat and scrapbooked.
Erica, I'm going to need you to tone it down.
Can I have a Xanax?
So she said her husband killed Joshua Ford in their penthouse bathroom. She said, quote, he made them strip at gunpoint. And I was like, oh my God. I was like, had no idea what was going on. That's literally how she said it. She also said, quote, and he told me that Josh said, I was in the Army, you were in the Navy, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? And BJ said that he looked at him in the face and said, see you later, motherfucker, and shot him in the head. The detective stated, Jeannie would have not been shot yet. And Erica responded, quote, she was just whimpering and she curled up in a... I think I mistyped something.
In the corner? With curl up underneath the...
This is what I typed. She was just whimpering and she curled up in a call and he missed her the first time. So,
in a call? So, in the corner, probably?
I don't know. So, and Erica responded, quote, she was just whimpering and she curled up in a corner and he missed her the first time and the second time he hit her right here. And she points to her left chest area. She continues... She curled up behind Joshua's body. Oh my God. I'm getting like really panicked. The detective asked, do you need to take a break? And she said, I'm okay. BJ told me she was just whimpering like a baby. So like part of her confession, she's
that she saw
first person. And then part of it, she then goes, BJ told me, you know, like,
yeah.
So cops really are not believing her story at all. But they're just continuing to try to get information from her. So the detectives ask her, like, what the bathroom looked like, what she saw. So Erica described the scene. It looked like a bad horror film. There's blood completely soaked everywhere. There are spots that if you stepped, it would splash. There was puddles of blood. She stated that while Ben was butchering the victim, she was laying downstairs, quote, and I'm like curled up on the couch, just petrified. And I hear him say, come here. And I go up there and he's like, take my picture. And he's holding their heads. Okay.
Yeah, for my scrapbook.
And she said that he was standing naked while he was holding the heads. And so again, cops not believing her story. And again, why should they? Because she clearly had like all the evidence on her persons when she was arrested. So yeah. During their separate trials, they continued to point the finger at each other. In Ben's trial, his former Navy comrade in arms, Michael McInnes, indicated that in 1999, when the two were out drinking at a strip club, Ben stated that if he ever committed a murder, he would dismember the body, cut up the pieces, put them in trash bags, and dispose of them in dumpsters, either many dumpsters or the same dumpster over several days, which clearly, you know, he thought about well.
So, yeah, clearly he thought about this beforehand.
So McInnes, who had recently left the Navy with a less than honorable discharge, was vague during his testimony when it came to time and place and specifics of this conversation, but he did state that after they continued to drink, McInnes began to complain to Ben about his own marital issues and joked that maybe he should send Ben to go whack his wife, to which Ben jokingly agreed and indicated the price would be around $20,000. McInnes then qualified the conversation, stating that it was just guys talking trash and drinking and that it shouldn't be taken seriously. Ben's trial was first, and on April 3rd, 2003, he was convicted of first-degree murder and second-degree murder in the death of Martha Jeannie Crutchley and was acquitted of all charges with regards to Joshua Ford's death. He was sentenced to 38 years in prison. Erica's trial then started in early June, and on June 11th, 2003, Erica was convicted of first-degree murder of the death of Joshua Ford and second-degree murder for the death of Martha Jeannie Crutchley. She was sentenced to life in prison plus 20 years in August of 2003. So he got 38 because the jury basically believed that she killed him, that she killed Joshua. She was responsible for it. She got life plus 20. 7 years after they were convicted, so in 2010, Ben decided to divorce Erica while behind bars. And Ben is actually eligible for parole this year, 2021, while Erica is up for parole in 2024.
Oh. Awesome.
So let's hope they don't get it.
Yeah.
And that's the story of the killer couple, Benjamin and Erica Seifert.
Cool. I think I'd heard that one before, though. It sounds familiar.
Yeah.
On like one of my murder shows. But
for sure.
I forgot a lot of the stuff about it. Well, hey, do you want a scrapbook?
No. Let's scrapbook about this episode. So, thanks for listening.
Thanks for the murder story, Jen. I'm going to scrapbook that today in my scrapbook. Everyone, get your scrapbook stuff out. Scrapbook the story.
All the stories. So come back next time for more stories.
We'll have more
stories. Listen to our old episodes.
Yeah. Give us a like. Give us a subscribe.
Follow us on the IG. And we'll see you in the next episode.
Bye!